Welcome to the Compassionate Educators Show for teachers who desire to change lives without self-sacrifice. Let's dig deep together into the skill set, mindset, and best practices you and your students need to thrive in today's schools. Now your host, Marie Cooney.
Hello, Compassionate Educators. Welcome to today's episode of the Compassionate Educators Show. I am so very honored to have a special guest here with us today. Kristen Hovius is here with us to talk more about social and emotional learning. Kristen Hovius, she, her, hers, founded SEL Chicago to support adults in the important hard work of creating mutually respectful environments for young people with intention. Hovius is currently serving local school districts, including Chicago Public Schools, Illinois State University's Chicago Teacher Education Programs, and private and parochial schools in Chicagoland. Hovius led Chicago's Tortiva Institute as both education director from 2007 to 2008 and adjunct faculty member 2006 to 2017, and became a certified positive discipline trainer. Her love of anatomy and the science of human development led her to the work of social-emotional learning. Hovius continues to grow in her practice and is pursuing her Master's of Science in Psychology at Indiana Institute of Technology, and has recently authored Our Brain Book, a children's rhyming book written to support adults and children in the skills of self-regulation. And Kristen, I'm so excited to see Our Brain Book in its full state, because I think this is such a fascinating and fabulous way that you are getting across self-regulation skills for children. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Brain Book?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Marie. The Brain Book actually started when my kids were really little, before I was doing any of this work. My children are 14 months apart. So when they were 3 and 2, I was giving them vitamins, and they took the liquid vitamins, which are, they just smell horrible. I can still smell the smell. And they would line up like little birds for their vitamins. And I gave Ava her vitamin. She's my younger child, swallowed, no problem. Julian came over to take his, and he inhaled instead of swallowing. And so he started coughing, and he looked terrified. And because I was an anatomy teacher at the time, and I literally had anatomy books everywhere, I scooped him up and I rubbed his back, and I said, I bet this is so scary. Here, the vitamins went down your trachea. That's where you breathe. It should have gone down your esophagus. That's where everything goes to your stomach. Your body's doing exactly what it's supposed to do. And while he still felt scared, I could feel him relax. I didn't even think about it. And 6 months later, Ava took something and it went down her trachea. She started coughing. And he ran over and rubbed her back and said, it's okay, Ava. It went down your trachea. It was supposed to go down your esophagus. But it's your body doing exactly what it's supposed to do. Like almost, because he was, 3 and a half at the time. And in that moment, the power of language was so clear to me. The power of telling children what their bodies do, the power of using the big words and not being afraid of using the anatomically correct words for all body parts. And we can have another conversation at a different time about a different topic about body parts. it's so empowering for our children to know about their bodies and their structures. And so when I then became moving into the space of using this in my classroom when I was in Chicago, and using the work of positive discipline in my vocational classroom, and then really doing the hard work of using positive discipline in raising my own children, because I believe it's It's one thing to lead classrooms of other people's children, and then doing this hard work of leading your own family with grace is really, really difficult. So when I got into a point where I was in a school and I had just read Heather Forbes's book, Help for Billy. And Heather Forbes says that all children who are dysregulated are seeking safety. What can we do as adults to provide them safety? And there was this fourth grader who had become dysregulated, and every time he had encountered an adult, the adult created an environment between them and the child where there was more adrenaline than there was oxytocin. There was more fire than there was calm. And it wasn't, in that moment, I was able to be helpful. And I said to myself, there has to be some way that we can, in a rhyming way, in a fun way, teach even these big things to smaller kids. And guess what? Adults need to have this too. So the Brain Book was really born out of wanting there to be a way that is anatomy-based so that the cerebral cortex, which manages the essential question of what can I learn? How can I solve this problem? The limbic system, which manages the essential question of am I loved? Am I cared about? And the brainstem, which manages that essential question, am I safe? The Brain Book comes from wanting to share those three brain parts and share the importance of co-regulation, the importance of the adult maintaining, finding somehow a calm response when our mirror neurons want us to get down with the chaos with the kid. So I wrote the poem that is the beginning of the Brain Book in a week. And 15 months later, we're going to be publishing next week. So it's really exciting.
That is absolutely wonderful. Well, congratulations. And again, I cannot wait to see it. And I think this is going to be a wonderful tool for every classroom. I would love to see the Brain Book in every classroom across the nation. Because like you said, it's so important for children to understand what is happening in their own bodies. And if we are not going to help them understand that, then what?
Yeah, I also really want to be clear in putting attributes, right? The Brain Book is, if your listeners are familiar with Dr. Dan Siegel, he uses and coined a phrase called flip my lid. So you tuck your thumb into your palm, you cover it up with your fingers become the cortex, your thumb becomes the limbic system, your wrist becomes the brainstem. And it's this wonderful visual that is used in a lot of different ways, and it is a foundational tool in a positive discipline classroom. But I wrote the Brain Book so that we could have a rhyming way of learning some of those things, something in a cool-off spot or an area where a chill-out corner that we're creating in the classroom, so something, an anchor that could be there after you read it to a classroom. And it's just really important to me that not only is this book a illustrated rhyming children's story, but it also has really detailed footnotes called Notes for the Curious, which talks about all of the science behind each of the tools. So we have permission from Dan Siegel to use Flip My Lid. I reference, and we have permission from Becky Bailey from Conscious Discipline to use her essential questions, and then referencing the work of Heather Forbes and lots of positive discipline work from Jane Nelson and some of the other trainers. Jody McVitie is one of the authors of the Positive Discipline in Schools and Classrooms manual. So I'm really, not only is this an illustration book, but it's also almost a primer on, if you want to dive into this space of creating mutually respectful relationships, there's a whole lot of science behind it. And I think that can really help, because I know that in a world where we're trying to move to restorative practices, And the state of Illinois actually made a Senate Bill 100 in 2015. So really trying to take away the disproportionate discipline for our students of color by passing a law that helps us, if suspensions and expulsions are even going to be tried, what happened before that? And so we're really trying to, as a state, combat this disproportionate discipline. The pendulum swing with that can be, if I take away these punitive measures and I'm not given anything else as an educator, what else is there?
That's the big question that comes up for so many teachers, that they want to have another way. They want to have another method, but they do feel that if a student makes a decision that is potentially not conducive to the learning environment, let's just say, a lot of times the question I get is, well, how can they come back into the classroom and everything, I'm supposed to act like everything is okay, and how can we continue, and how can we go on when there's been no punishment? And that word sometimes comes up, the word punishment, and I'm hoping that we can move away from the word punishment and look at how we can help the students, as you said, help with the co-regulation. Let's look at the mutually respectful relationships. You mentioned both of those, and I think that is going to be so important at looking at what has come before the action and how that plays in.
Well, I think you mentioned a really important words, right? So there's this idea of punishment, right? And when we're looking at creating classrooms, and I've been really inspired by the work of nonviolence, right? And nonviolence is not simply the absence of violence, but it is the hard work of not adding to the turmoil. And I think that if we are actively going to create a classroom that is a beloved community in the Kingian type of nonviolence, a beloved community is a place where harms that happen are able to be made amends for. Punishment does not allow anyone to make amends. And in a culture that wants there to be an eye for an eye, where punishment comes from, there's no place to learn a new skill. And so I'm also really inspired by the work of Ross Green, right? He says that children will do well if they can. And if they're not doing well, that means they're lagging some sort of skill. What is the skill that this child is missing? We cannot ask that question as an educator unless we are self-regulated ourselves, because our curiosity, our ability to problem solve, our ability to look at a problem from all of its angles and problem solve with deep wisdom and empathy is only available if we are self-regulated. Punishment often comes from a very dysregulated place, and healing typically doesn't happen in punishment. So I believe that educators really want to be in right relations with their students. And sometimes we don't have a definition of what relationships are. The Search Institute have been recently introduced to their work up in Minneapolis. One of the definitions they have of a developmental relationship is, yes, one that shows caring, but also one that shares power. Mm. And when we share power with children, what we create is a mutually respectful environment. When we share power with another human being, we are showing some of our vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And when we do that, we're also creating a foundation for trust. I think that what is often challenging, right, is that how can I share power with children? How is that possible? And one of the big pieces of work that I end up doing is talking about the structures that we create in the beginning, if we can create agreements and guidelines that are co-created with our students, co-created guidelines are much more easily and readily shared by students, because no one really wants to be told what to do. Adults don't want to be told what to do. But if we can start with, and this is this house of positive discipline, it starts with agreements and guidelines. Firmness keeps us safe. It starts with routines. What are the individual routines in each of the classrooms? Or what are the individual routines if we're thinking about a family that cause dysregulation? And or when do routines happen? And so how can we really build those routines and give everyone an opportunity to practice and then practice again and practice again, be reviewed and reflective in a non-judgmental way? I remember getting into the car on a very dysregulated morning with my kids and getting into the seats, and we all just kind of took a deep breath and said, and I looked in the rearview mirror, I'm like, that didn't go nearly like I wanted to. Mm-hmm. I yelled way too much. That must have been really uncomfortable for you guys. And just sort of saying that, owning my part of the problem, is a way that we can share power. And it's also a way that we can model non-judgment. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen perfectly. I really want to be really clear that I am imperfect in everything that I do.
We are human though. And the compassionate educators that I work with, I continuously urge them to share that space and to, as you said, co-create with the students. Mm-hmm. Because yes, there are guidelines that must be followed. However, there's also a lot of room for flexibility in terms of what is it that we expect from each other? What is it that we expect of our classroom? And how can we create this together? And I have one teacher who, she sat down and together with her class, they created a classroom pledge. She started out with one suggestion, and then suddenly her students were very much engaged and they were offering more. And she was so surprised by what they had offered for what they want to see happening in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And it was so powerful for her, because by giving them power, everybody felt more connected, and she saw that they were truly listening to what she was teaching. And so by her modeling what she wanted to see, they in turn demonstrated that they want for their peers to feel safe in their classroom. They want to be able to listen to each other. They want those opportunities. And when someone is maybe having a bad day, then they can look at those reminders and they know that they were part of that creation rather than just being told what to do. And it makes it so much more powerful, and it makes it so much easier to handle challenges, I think, in the classroom too, when the students have that opportunity to co-create and to truly be a part of, as you said, a mutually respectful relationship.
I would add one piece to what you've created. My guess is that this particular teacher does something when she notices that the agreement is not being met that doesn't single any one student out, right? Mm-hmm. Because we can create all of the guidelines. We can co-create all the guidelines and make the beautiful anchor charts and the posters that we want. And when one member of the community becomes dysregulated, if it's true that that member of the community is actually seeking safety, calling that student out for not maintaining that agreement, especially in a public way, is not a way to create safety. In the routines lessons and in the agreements lessons in positive discipline, there's a piece that says moving it forward. And when we move it forward, when we're noticing that things aren't going well, we can ask the classroom, what was our agreement? Being really, really clear that it's using an our we pronoun that is referencing all of us and not what was your agreement, meaning your agreement to me. Absolutely. As the person who has the power in the room. So what was our agreement? How are we all doing? How do you individually think we're doing? With a thumbs up, thumbs sideways, or down? Take a pause, let everyone choose how they're feeling. And then another question is, what's one thing that you can do individually to come back to our agreement? Do that now, please. It also helps in the before you make that subtle correction that you make lots of connections beforehand.
Yes. Yes. So important.
Yeah. So the connection before correction is another tool that Dan Siegel talks about, connection before. I don't remember his exact quote, but the connection before correction is absolutely a positive discipline tool.
Yeah. And I know that a lot of schools are adapting PBIS as well. And I know that in the PBIS mm-hmm. model, they say, well, I know at one point it was four connections for every correction. I know that they say the more, the better. So the four mm-hmm. to one is a minimum, but the more connection that you can make before any type of correction. And like you said, not singling out a specific child, because that leads to feelings of less safety in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And that becomes, instead of a safe harbor, then it becomes a place where they have that fight, flight, or freeze. And that's really hard to recover from.
It really is. And since you mentioned some, one of the 4-to-1 ratio for that I've seen used for PBIS, I also think that there's a important distinction to make between what is praise and what is encouragement. Because praise, I like the way you're sitting. You did it just like I told you to. You really know how to please me, right? Those are very clearly praise statements. And encouragement, and when I'm praising someone, often it's all about me, mm-hmm. the adult in the room, versus you must feel really good about that. Thank you very much for your contribution. It was so helpful. I care about you no matter what. Those are deep encouragement statements. And this idea of encouragement goes all the way back to Alfred Adler and Rudolf Dreiker's. If we think about encouragement as the key, Dreiker's quote, which is the one that lived with me, especially when I was in the very beginning on this path with my young children in my home. I taught adults, right? I was an adult educator. When I was working with my home, in my home and with my own children, this quote stuck with me, which is a misbehaving child is a discouraged child. And that's from Dreiker. So what are they discouraged from? They're discouraged from belonging and significance. It's usually something about them feeling some sort of fracture with the community. Is it the community of the classroom? Is it community of the home? Is it the community between me and this child? Connection is often the key. Mm-hmm. Because then this works physiologically. If I don't connect with this student, I can't possibly correct them because their cortex cannot hear me. Connection allows for the possibility of just a little bit of self-calm and a little bit of self-regulation so that the correction could actually land in the brain and be used.
That's so powerful. That's so, so very powerful. And I think even just that one idea right there is absolute gold, Kristen.
Yeah. For me, as I've been leading educators in this work for the last few years, the power of aligning it with what is happening actually in the brain has been really helpful for those educators that feel like restorative practices are permissive. Mm. Because if it's not authoritarian and controlling, if this behavior of this child is not controlled, then it's wishy-washy and pushover. And I believe that because so few of us were led in an authoritative way when we were young, kind and firm at the same time, connected and holding people respectfully to account, that when we become dysregulated, we being the adults in the room, we don't have a deep well of authoritative, kind and firm tools to go into. That's another reason that if I could just take a breath, right? Mm-hmm. Before I choose to respond. But even in that moment, I think that we know that that's not going to happen, and it's certainly not going to happen all the time. So going back after your calm to begin to make a repair, and how can we make that repair? We get this golden opportunity to model respectful repair with children who may have become further dysregulated from our reaction. And that's being able to model apology.
Absolutely. I think that you've given us so much that as teachers, we can go into the classroom and really begin the practice of helping students with the social emotional learning and the regulation by, one, using science to help our students understand what's going on in their bodies and what's happening with their emotions, connecting with the students, making sure that we are working on our own ability to regulate our emotions. Even like you said, just taking a breath when someone gets under our skin, because we are human too, taking a breath and modeling how it is that we handle our own emotions and working to repair relationships and modeling apologies. I think that's so significant because as adults, we are the ones who are the example for our students. And so what are we doing to be that model for them?
Yes.
Kristen, I mean, just so much amazing, amazing gifts that you have presented here today and hours worth of information. And I know that you truly do have a full training on how teachers and also how parents can learn more about what it is that you're working on, all of this information that you have been putting together in a training. Can you tell us more about that?
Oh, sure. So my company is called SEL Chicago, and I work in really four ways. I do offer work with parents, so schools will hire me to run parent workshops. And we use experiential learning tools to help adults sort of get into the seat of what it's like to be a child and giving some practical tools that will be immediately helpful the next time there's conflict at home. The beautiful thing is that those same sort of experiential learning workshops are workshops that we do for teachers. So I am a certified positive discipline trainer, and I run public workshops that are available. I typically host them in the Chicago area. The next workshop that I have in Chicago is in the Beverly neighborhood, which is in the south part of the city. So if you are someone who is on an SEL committee or school climate and culture team, or you're responsible for leading other adults in this work, you leave with the ability to facilitate some of these activities back in your school. I will create a list of what are the positive discipline theories and the approach so that your listeners can be really, really clear about what the theory is and some reflection questions when things don't work. And I'd love to Absolutely. Provide that to you guys.
Absolutely. That sounds wonderful. And we will definitely include that in the show notes. And it's so true that there's not a lot of support. And that's why, Kristen, I think that we are so aligned, because we are working on making sure that teachers have, like you said, not only the tool set, the skill set, and the mindset so that they can go into the classrooms and effectively, truly be life-changing teachers, in the sense that they are truly making those connections with the students and helping the students to, you know, really be engaged and uplifted in a new way. It's just really, really significant. So I thank you. I thank you for sharing and for being here, being present. And so thank you for, you know, being on the front lines and making sure that our students are, you know, getting what they need to show up in this world confident and courageous and being respected.
Well, you're welcome. My world is, I feel so honored because I'm full of opportunities to help adults cultivate these relationships with children where both people can show up and be in a right relationship with one another. And I also believe that it is some deep form of self-care. We want to be in right relationships with the other human beings in our spheres of influence. And it is a deep form of self-care to be able to make amends with people and to attune to what they need. And so I'm over the moon that this is my life. It's terrific.
Oh, that is so beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. All right. Well, we will make sure that we include all the additional information in the show notes. Yes, as well as information on how our listeners can connect with you and stay in touch with the amazing work that you are doing in this world.
And the listeners can go really easily. I spoke in this podcast, we spoke about a workshop that's coming up in February of 2020. But if you're listening to this podcast afterwards, go to www.selchicago.com. And there is a link to on the events page to things that are happening right now.
Perfect. All right. Well, thank you so very much, Kristen, for being with us today and talking all things SEL and connection. Mm-hmm. And absolutely a pleasure having you with us today.
It was my great pleasure. May the superpower of self-regulation be yours.
Before you go, I want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart for being here with us today. I am so honored that you have taken your time to listen to the Compassionate Educators Show. I hope that you have gained some valuable, simple yet effective strategies that you can bring with you into the classroom, into your everyday life, so that you can continue to be the life-changing teacher that is in your heart, and you can do that without sacrificing yourself in the process. Now, if you've gained what you need from this episode, then please go out and change some lives. If you feel, though, that you would like to dig a little bit deeper and you maybe would like to come up with a personal plan as to how you're going to implement these strategies, feel free to schedule a call with me. I do have a few slots opening up this month for some free strategy calls. Now, I'm going to do something that I've never done before, and I'm going to share with you my personal schedule link so that you can go ahead and book that call before they are filled. So you can go to compassionateeducators.as.me. Again, that's compassionateeducators.as.me. And I will also share that in the show notes as well. So feel free to book that call. We can have a discussion and talk about how you can continue to bring these strategies into your life, into your classroom, into your world, so that you can continue to make a difference. Thank you for being a compassionate educator.